Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
From the Boston Globe, this is Rhode Island Report. I'm Ed Fitzpatrick. Welcome back to the podcast where we bring you big conversations from our very small state. We've got a special bonus episode for you today. It's an edited version of Roadmap Live, a conversation with local leaders on the state of Rhode Island schools. The event was moderated by our own Dan McGowan and Steph Machado. I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Dan McGowan. My colleague Steph Machado and I are going to be moderating this wonderful panel.
And we have three excellent panelists here tonight who are going to bring us different perspectives on education and youth from children's earliest years through higher ed. So starting with Rhode Island Department of Education Deputy Commissioner Lisa Odom Vallela. Thank you so much for being here. We have Central Falls Mayor Maria Rivera. Thank you. And Post-Secondary Commissioner Shannon Gilkey. Let's give our panelists a quick round of applause. So we're going to start with Deputy Commissioner. I want to talk about the ongoing crisis in recruiting and retaining a teaching workforce here in Rhode Island. And state leaders often point out this is a nationwide problem. It's not just happening here in Rhode Island, but at RIDE, your job is to focus on what's going on in Rhode Island. So it's very easy for a teacher to live in Rhode Island and go across the border to Massachusetts where they can get a higher paying position. Should we be paying teachers more in Rhode Island, or what is the solution to the workforce shortage that we have?
I see a lot of nodding teachers' heads. Yes, we should be getting paid more. I don't think anyone would argue that. I think it's twofold, and I'm preaching to the choir to our teachers out there. It is hard to be a teacher. I mean, there's just no question. It is especially hard after coming out of the pandemic. We're still dealing with a lot of issues, a lot of trauma, both for our teachers and our students. So it's hard. I think part of that is one of the reasons of that difficulty in attracting and retaining some teachers. The conditions have certainly changed. And then just the requirements of what's needed. But to your point, people can go across town, across state lines. We've had pension changes over the years, teacher pay, and then again, certainly the funding that's coming. We're about to lose a lot of funding from the federal. So, you know, now it's really that weight is now on the state level and local level. There's just a host of issues. At RIDE, we are certainly trying to support teachers. We've launched, I don't know if anyone has had the opportunity to scope it out, but we've launched the Educate 401 website. So on there, we have resources. We actually have a virtual job fair coming up, and then we'll have two statewide in-person job fairs to be able to interview folks right on the spot and hopefully bring some teachers right into the profession. So that'll be at the Crown Plaza in Warwick.
And you mentioned that expiring COVID relief money. Is it going to be difficult? Like, will the state continue to be able to provide incentives for people to get certified in sort of those hard-to-fill teacher areas like special ed, MLL? Or is that, are we not in a place right now where the state can pay for that?
Well, so the state didn't actually pay for those. Those are all from the districts using their district ESSER money. So each district managed that a little differently. The state didn't have specific. We've had it from using some of our RIDE ESSER money. We've paid for different professional learning. We've had cohorts where we supported teachers in being able to pass the Praxis exam. We've had communities of practice for educators of color to support them as they're coming into new teachers. So we've used our ESSER money to do some supports, but how each district used their money to support teachers and incentives and pay for certifications and that type of thing was varied by district.
Commissioner Gilkey, let's grant you a magic wand tonight. You get to solve the teacher shortage challenge in this state. What's the one thing you would do if no politics, nothing got in the way, to make sure that more of our students graduating from, let's say, the public colleges in Rhode Island were becoming teachers, and particularly in those hard-to-reach subjects?
Yeah, thank you for the question. My first job was a high school teacher. I was a career and technical educator in Louisville, Kentucky, and went through a traditional teacher prep program for agriculture education. So this is, you know, something. But the one thing I would do is really look at, you know, how we make the profession, how we elevate the profession. So magic wand, you know, what are three things for that? One, you got to take a hard look at the career ladder for a teacher, starting with student teaching. We talk about earn and learn programs, the value of apprenticeships, work-based learning. But when I did my student teaching experience, you know, I was, you know, camping out of my parents' house, driving 45 minutes one way, working a job at Applebee's as a server on the weekend so I could, you know, afford gas money. And that complete experience, when you're still paying tuition at an institution of higher ed, is costing you money. And I was, you know, fortunate enough to have my parents. I could live there. We have a lot of families the students are going through teacher prep programs, in my opinion, that don't have that backstop. But then looking at the compensation rates, and then look at the career ladders beyond, you know, after you hit about 5 years, you know, how do you have a established career ladder where you can retain the teacher in the profession for long term, becoming a master teacher, you know, offering professional development. And I think there's models out there in the medical world where we can look at to help make the profession a lot more lucrative than it is. And higher education has an equal role in that responsibility with our Department of Education and with our federal partners at the U.S. Department of Education.
Yeah, I mean, just to stick on that, and I wonder the role that you can play in actually making this possible. Like, I recognize that you can't snap your fingers unless you have the magic wand to pay teachers more overnight. But, you know, the incentives potentially to keep teachers in Rhode Island, I wonder how much we can, you know, potentially have a program that, I don't know, keep teachers here for commit to 5 years, and maybe you get 4 years at RIC-free instead of 2 years. I mean, what kind of out of the box thinking is happening right now?
Yeah. So what we have going for us is we have a pipeline of if we talk about affordability, I'll probably repeat this, to CCRI promise program, 2 years free, you know, high transfer rates that we're working on to Rhode Island College. At Rhode Island College, we just introduced the HOPE scholarship that pays for the junior and the senior year. Again, last dollar, got to use your Pell. And Rhode Island colleges, you know, has historically been our teacher prep colleges. But we also have an in-state scholarship program that runs through our office that goes to even to our private institutions to address affordability. The other thing I think is really important is our WaveMaker student loan forgiveness program. When you couple that, which is teachers are eligible for that, when you couple that with the federal student loan forgiveness programs, we're trying to lower the cost in the state. And I think Rhode Island's pretty generous when it comes to, you know, the WaveMaker plus the federal programs. So affordability, affordability, affordability. And then really looking at that career ladder, you know, out-of-the-box creative thinking, how do we create like a master teacher program that allows an individual to advance? And it's something that I think we should be working on together. I think the stuff that I love seeing coming out of RIDE in our apprenticeship programs is an apprenticeship model that allows a working adult to earn and learn at the same time. And I know the department's been working on that with the Building Futures program, because you have a teacher assistant that might want to become a teacher. And so that allows them to keep making that income, but also work towards being a teacher.
Mayor Rivera, you represent one of our urban core cities that is struggling with low proficiency rates in the school system and a high number of students that are economically disadvantaged. I know you want to attract more people to live in Central Falls. In order to do that, you need better schools. In order to have better schools, you need a larger tax base and more money for the schools. It's sort of a chicken or the egg situation. Tell me what you're doing to try to tackle that problem.
Definitely. Thank you for the question, and thank you for hosting this. I think education should be on everybody's top of the list. So when I came into office, education was my priority. One of the first things I did was I advocated for funding for a new high school, which we got, and we're going to be having a groundbreaking pretty soon. But having a new high school is not the solution, right? Like a new building is not the solution to the student outcomes. So at the same time, I started thinking, what do we have to do so that we can help our students succeed? Central Falls will always be the lowest and poorest black and brown community if we don't focus on education, and that needs to change. This has happened for way too long. So I took it upon myself to raise some funds to hire a chief education strategist and start the Office of Education Strategy to do an overall analysis of what's happening in the district. This is not a position that we're looking at to point fingers. This is a position where I want Dr. Sarah Friedman, who is the person that I hired for this, who understands Central Falls, who started a school in Central Falls, who speaks the language, who knows this community, to speak with teachers, to speak with the community. I think it's so important that we meet with the teachers, that we speak to the teachers. I'm not sure that has happened. Right? I feel like our teachers are struggling and we ask them for so much, but we're not listening to them. We're not speaking to the families. We had a community meeting today. The community meeting is not for them to hear from us. The community meeting is for us to hear from them. What do you want to see different? You talked about the challenging community. You know, there's food insecurities, there's housing insecurities, there's so many different challenges in Central Falls that we have to overcome, and we need to focus on the education if we want to see our students succeed, and we want to see Central Falls in a different place. She has 2 years to do this work and present to us what's the outcome of her work. This is not going to be another report. We're just going to present another report, and nothing's going to be done out of this. This is a report where I want people to know what are the challenges in Central Falls, and I'll give you the perfect example. Sarah has met with 143 teachers, and the stories we hear are sad. Our teachers are struggling. When you hear from a teacher who doesn't speak Spanish, saying she has students in her classroom who don't speak English, and she doesn't have support in her classroom, how do we expect outcomes to change? Outcomes are never going to change. And this isn't, I think this is a resource problem. It's a systems issue. We need more resources in our community. We should be supporting our teachers with this. We should also be listening to the students and the families. You know, when you talk about attendance, the attendance is an issue. But are we asking the students and talking to the students, like, why are you out of school so much? They come with many different challenges. Mental health is a huge concern. We need to identify what these gaps are so that we can start working on these gaps.
We are going to get to the absenteeism problem. Tell us, what are some of the reasons that you hear in your community why students are chronically absent?
Food insecurities, housing insecurities. We have students who work their shift.
They're going to work overnight.
They're going to work overnight.
Going to school in the morning.
And then have to go to school in the morning. It's very hard. They have to take care of their siblings. They have to support their families. You have single moms with 5 kids. The high school students are working to support that family, not only to support their family here, but also to support their family in their country.
Can we just pause for a second and think about going to high school and then working third shift afterwards? It's heartbreaking. Thanks for sharing that, Mayor.
It's very heartbreaking.
And it's not just, I mean, I 100% hear what Mayor is saying in Central Falls. And sadly, it's not just in Central Falls. This is happening across the state and across the nation.
I know we have a lot of Providence teachers here. You know the same story. Commissioner, I want to ask you the same question about absenteeism. I think I'll give Governor McKee a lot of credit for something. Anyone who's covered education, certainly a lot of people in this room, we've all known it, absenteeism was a challenge for a very long time. I remember writing about chronic absenteeism 12 years ago and people looking at me a little bit crazy. What's chronic absenteeism? I think the governor's done a really good job of highlighting that, and then Ride has done an excellent job of really highlighting that and making it a top priority. And we're seeing results. More kids are coming to school this year than last year. I do wonder how much of that is things are normalizing a little bit post-pandemic. But I'd love you to talk a little bit about the you know, initiatives that you've taken. What do you find is working, not just in the urban corridor, but across the state in terms of getting students back in the classroom?
ride in myself personally. We can't take that credit. That's all districts. They are working really hard with how they're really approaching a multi-tiered support system to all of their students and really bringing in attendance as one of those components. So, you know, there's looking at the instruction and then providing supports around academics for those who need additional supports, tier two, tier three, looking at attendance, looking at behavioral supports. So just bringing that all in, a lot of districts are doing an amazing job looking at individual students, to the mayor's point of why is this student chronically absent, what, you know, is going on in their family life as well as what's happening at school, and then trying to build individual supports. We have districts that are going out, knocking on doors, meeting with their families in their home, really trying to bring those full supports for students. We have smart clinics that are opening up and other supports to provide services to the whole student. You know, we try to provide it all, counseling services, mental health services. There's a lot going on in students and families' lives, and taking that whole child approach is what's helping students get to school, and then trying to figure out, once they're here, how are we supporting them academically and with their social emotional needs.
And yet, when I looked it up just before we started, we still have a real absenteeism problem. I think there's 13 or 14 schools in our state, largely high schools, where we're still seeing 40% of kids or more on track to be chronically absent. We're talking big schools, typically the Central Falls, the Providence schools of the world, not entirely. What's the next step to get that number from, let's say, a school that's 45% chronically absent to something that is, you know, it was something where we're not getting one out of 2 days of, or one out of two kids being chronically absent? And I wonder, you know, we get a lot of emails from people who I think their initial reaction on absenteeism is, wait a minute, when I was in school, I had to go to school every day. It was an expectation. And there's this thought, I'm not sure it's totally true, but there's this thought from a lot of people that, you know, if I didn't go to school, I would have been suspended, I would have been expelled, I would have been kicked out. Again, that's actually not entirely true. But I do wonder about that sort of the disciplinary angle there of, you know, is there something that we have to do as a state to ensure that, you know, kids really are coming? And is there some sort of discipline, whether it's with families, you know, that kind of conversation? I know it's an uncomfortable one, but is there a disciplinary angle that we have to approach?
We try to take a more restorative and getting at the root cause of the problem as opposed to discipline. We don't suspend students for lack of attendance. It's really, you know,
it's counterintuitive, right?
Suspension, right. I mean, that's what people want, right? You know, the suspension really is, you know, limited to, you know, severe or behavior that would in any way cause, you know, threat or harm to others. So we don't take that approach. It's usually more of a restorative approach. But I think really, you know, that next piece is, you know, one, addressing those students that are needing to work to support their families. So we are working as part of our secondary reg work, you know, trying to award credit or being flexible with districts. Districts are looking at their scheduling patterns. How can they, you know, work to be able to do some work-based learning or work credit to be able to get credit for their work time as part of their, you know, a way to demonstrate their skills, right? We have those durable skills or transferable skills. So how can we give students credit for those types of opportunities? Finding ways to engage. I think that's, you know, probably the next big piece. Kids need to be engaged when they're coming into school. And so really, like, we see a huge level of engagement through our career and tech ed programs. So getting students in, doing hands-on learning, you know, to try to really engage students once they're there, and then addressing some of their needs. When there's those gaps, you know, whether it's through their educational journey, in and out of school. A lot of our students are chronically absent, not just 1 or 2 years, but there's been a pattern over the years. You know, imagine coming to school and not knowing what is going on in your classrooms. That's hard to not want to give up. And so how do we support that?
Is truancy court sort of out of fashion as something to use to address attendance problems?
No, truancy court still exists. There was a little bit of a lapse there during the pandemic. We weren't holding them in the schools. Some of it is coming back, trying to support. Again, it's more of that restorative approach. So when truancy court is involved, unless you're getting to like the real family court, you know, there's a couple different layers. But the truancy court at the school level really is trying to focus on working with the families, working with the students, working with the teachers of trying to find those supports to get students in. But that's still there. It still exists.
You know, I wouldn't want to take the spotlight off of the attendance issues in K-12 because I think it's something that I'm really glad, again, to your point, Dan, the McKee administration is really focusing on it. I think it's, you know, the right data to look at, but it shows up in higher ed. You know, when you miss that instructional time, and they successfully make the transition from a high school into post secondary, and you know the typical mathematical and literacy barriers. You know, in the pandemic, in my opinion, just poured gasoline on that issue, and also. You know, for the students that spent a lot of time electronically during the pandemic, had a lot of social development needs as well, right? Before the pandemic happened, we know in higher ed that the average, the root cause, like, think about the root cause, Lisa, the average student is working more. They're taking care of loved ones across the whole population spectrum, and which causes them as 18 and up, deprioritize the thing that they need to get into a good job. And I think part of this help that we can do with in post-secondary is to make sure that adults have access to good jobs. Because when you open up a good job for a family, you don't need your kid to work third shift anymore. You can bring home enough income where you're, because I don't believe parents wake up every day wanting their kid to go to work. But when it comes to paying your electric bill or it comes to taking care of your family member, you deprioritize the thing that the family needs the most. Generational wealth, we know, is higher forms of education and training. And so I think what we can do as a state in the post-secondary world to help out our young people and their families is to make sure the adults have a strategy to reach that good job and that we can break down their barriers. And a lot of those are non-academic barriers. It's food insecurity, it's housing, it's transportation issues so that they can enter the workforce at a higher income rate and then open up the opportunities for wonderful education for their families.
And sticking with you, Commissioner Gilkey, you know, we have always heard that a college degree is the way to get to generational wealth. And I know Dan and I grew up in a generation where you had to go to college. It was, unless you were going into military service after high school, there was no other option presented to you by your teachers, your guidance counselors, your parents. But these days, we have these great career and technical programs in a lot of high schools. You can learn to be a firefighter. You can learn to be a welder. And we're seeing students making that choice that they could go straight into the workforce after high school rather than go to college and get saddled with student debt. At the same time, we need students to go to college to become teachers and doctors in all of these industries that have a workforce shortage. So I guess what I'm wondering is, are you worried about the ongoing conversation about whether a college education is worth it?
Great question. It's also the topic of every Thanksgiving debate I have with my dad, who I'm a son of a Kentucky coal miner, and in my junior year of high school, I was a part of that same generation. You got to go to college to get a good job. And because my dad was a lifelong, or mostly lifelong coal miner before he was laid off, and the alternative in my part of Kentucky was to go work in the coal mines. He's like, do you want to do this, or do you want to do better than your mom and I have done for ourselves? And the coal mine is a very respectable job, but he wanted something better for his son. But fast forward 20 years later, and now my dad's a 69-year-old welder in our community, and he's like, son, I can't find enough welding because you guys keep telling people to go to college, and we don't have enough people in the trades, you know? So it hits home, that question, particularly with $1.7 trillion in student loan debt that we have in this country, affordability, right? So the quick data is this, and this is what I tell my dad. Generational wealth for low SES students, like my family was, first-generation college students, is about $1.4, $1.5 million difference between a four-year degree and a high school diploma. We know the best ticket for first-generation families is the path to a college degree, But we don't necessarily need to keep the model that we're using to get to that path to a four-year degree the same way we've been delivering it for 250 years. We have to figure out ways, particularly for our underserved populations, to have a path to a four-year degree that they can take care of their family, they can get work experience. So practically speaking, we have to better leverage the apprenticeship model. We have to make sure that every credential, particularly for underserved populations, but for the whole student client body, that it leads to a good job. We call that credentials of value in the space, so that we're not putting out, particularly with the price of higher education, we're not putting out a product that's not ready to go directly into the workforce. And then the third point I would say is that for a long time in this country, we've bifurcated going to college or getting a career. We've said that you either are on a college track or you're on a career track, and typically that includes, do you want to work in the trades or do you want to go to college? And I think what employers are telling us, and I just had breakfast with a owner of a plumbing company this morning, we need both. We need skills, workplace skills, and we also need that academic knowledge. The final thing I would say about, is higher ed worth it? I love to talk about the workforce, because typically when you talk to a family, they need that person to get a good job, right? But the things we know about post-secondary education is that we have better voting status, we have more civic engagement in their communities, more volunteer experience, we have better health outcomes, we have better generational wealth. So there's other societal impacts that I think that hit our community if we have a better educated population. So do we need to fix the affordability issues? We need to have programs that reduce those barriers? 100%. But I don't think we need to give up on the college experience.
Lisa, I want to bring you into this conversation, because there are a lot of CTE programs popping up in K-12 schools, particularly in high school, of course, which is great. Students are learning a skill and they might realize that they can go straight into that career right out of high school. Is there an unintended consequence of CTE that it might discourage someone from going to college?
Well, I would say that we as well are encouraging both. We are hoping that students are leaving college and career ready, and looking into doing both. We just recently in Providence had a good handful of students just get offered jobs at Electric Boat, making $50,000 to start. And because of the welding and the programs that are going on there, those students are prepared, they have credentials, and then they're able to still then go on to the commissioner's point of doing other avenues, whether it's going to technical college, whether it's doing other work. They're in a position where they can be doing both if they choose. We definitely have a shortage of, we hear all the time in our construction world, like, we don't have folks that are going into construction management, and the folks in that workforce are starting to age out. They're concerned about their companies continuing on, and really looking at making sure that kids know that they have both options. Our CTE programs over the past, since probably 2019, over tripled, probably 30% more programs that we have in the state of Rhode Island now, and they continue to grow. Students are getting college credits, through those programs. So it's not even your traditional, I see my former voc tech principal back there, and we don't use that word anymore. It is career and technical education. It is not you're going into the trades, and so there's the kids in the trades and then the kids that are going off to college. The programs that we are offering now in our schools are amazing. They're coming out with, cybersecurity, biotech programs. We have students are coming out of school with their Ponegansett High School kids are coming out with an EMT certification, college credits. We have criminal justice. I mean, these are not just, automotive or the traditional, construction that you may think of. They're coming out with high quality credentials for the industry plus college credits to give them that jump start. A lot of schools have articulation agreements with our local institutions to be able to then be able to just jump right in, and they want them to be coming to those programs. So it's not the old fashioned career in tech, and the students there, their attendance is better their graduation rate is better. And so we personally would love to see at some point, you know, CTE for all. You know, that makes a lot of people in this room happy. And that's really looking at how do you get those skills, even if it's just taking one or two classes. You know, when I was working in the district, so prior to coming to RIDE, I was assistant superintendent in two districts here in Rhode Island, and adding programs in both communities while I was there. And even just to allow students to be able to experience all of those different programs, and even if they come out and say, I realize now I don't want to be a doctor. I was on a field trip, and one of the biomed kids, she had it in her head forever. She was going to become a doctor. We went to the emergency room, and she passed out. And she was like, yeah, I don't think this is going to be for me. How wonderful for her parents that did not go and spend all that money on going to medical school. You know, so even if it's just finding a thing that we can rule out what we don't want and be able to experiment and have those opportunities to know what's out there. There's jobs out there that we can't even imagine now, especially with all the work that's going on with AI. I mean, who knows what the jobs will be. So we need to be able to prepare kids to be able to experience that. So it's not just our core academics. That's part of it. It's not just our, you know, curricular activities. That's part of it. But allowing kids to have those opportunities to see what's available, experiment them, get credentials, get college credit, so that they can make choices, you know, when they leave. So much to her parents' pleasure, she's off into another field and on her way. So, and that happens, you know, that's just one example. I can tell countless stories. CTE is a passion of mine. So, you know, I certainly encourage all students to at least dabble a little bit, even if they don't find and become a program, you know, completer, but trying to really experiment with some of those to be able to find that college and career. I think we can't emphasize that enough.
Steph and I both joke that we wanted to be journalists from the time we were like 7 years old. We got to college and passed out, but we just kept going, right? Yeah. So it's good. Mayor, one of the reasons I want to stick with you on this topic, because one of the reasons I love that you're on this panel is with respect to my commissioners up here, you face the voters and you talk to the voters by necessity. I'm curious, when you're talking to largely parents, I would imagine, what you hear about sort of their kind of hopes and dreams for their children, and the concerns about, you know, when it comes to getting a job versus going right to college. What do you hear, just when you're talking to your average resident in Central Falls?
I think our parents have a hard time navigating the system, right? There's a trust component to this. Who can they talk to? There's a large immigrant community. They want to see their students succeed. They're afraid to speak to people, so they feel comfortable with us, with me, because I speak the language. I look like them with a lot of people on my team. They have a hard time navigating the system, right? Like, who do we talk to? These are families that, you know, I wasn't part of your generation. I was told you have to go to college. It wasn't mandated. It's the same thing with the families in Central Falls still, and it's going to take time before that changes. They want to see their students succeed. And they lean on me and on my team to help them and guide them. Like, what can you do for my child? How can you help my student? It's the same thing with the district. Like, there's a lot of people that I speak to in the district, and we have conversations. They basically want us to hold their hand, to guide them, to make sure that we're helping their child through the proper steps to whatever they have to do, whether they're going to go to college, whether they're going to go to a trade program. Many of them are going to go to work. This is it's a cycle, and we need to try to break this cycle with the families in Central Falls.
I think you're 100% correct. You know, I think higher education, and there's wonderful, we have a rich higher education landscape in the state, frankly, for a state that's, you know, a little over a million people. We've got 13 wonderful institutions across the whole spectrum. There's no reason why we can't hit 70-80% of our population having a credential. But the mode of delivery is kind of, we always say we should meet people where they are, and it's a great line, but how you operationalize that is tougher at scale, right? And but I think you're absolutely right. I think first-gen families, particularly families that are coming to this country that may speak a different language, that's that mode of access and completion that we need to operationalize. And the point I'm trying to make is that we need to operationalize it. We have a declining K-12 to post-secondary population demographic, and we have an aging workforce. And at the same time, 99% of jobs post the 2008 banking crisis in this country require a credential beyond high school. And by 2030 in this, or around 2031 actually in this state, about 7 out of 10 jobs are going to require a credential. And we just don't have, frankly, guys, the workforce to keep up with that. And you think about the opportunities. I can name the industries. We think about them: healthcare, life sciences, IT, cyber, artificial intelligence, that are in the pipeline, the blue economy, right? The wind, renewable energy economy. We've got the jobs there, the good paying jobs. We just got to figure out the systems, I think, to your point, and how to operationalize that warm touch to get them into those training programs.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the other thing is parent engagement is super important. How do we continue to engage the parents to make sure that they're part of the conversations? And in a community like Central Falls, I keep talking about Central Falls because we're doing so much work there. It's hard because these parents are working two jobs. So if there is a board of trustees meeting happening, families aren't showing up. We're hosting community meetings. Like, we have to beg people. They have to take time out of their jobs to do this, and they have rent to pay. And it's no secret that rents are through the roof right now, right? They can't afford to miss a day out of work to go to a community meeting. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
We'll have a different panel on housing at some point, I think, because it's important. Mayor, you talked about the importance of you specifically being able to speak the language, right? Often Spanish when it comes to Central Falls. I think it's so important. And I think one of the things when it comes to multilingual learners that we talk about is, and the media, myself and Steph, and are guilty of this at times, but I think this is a kind of a statewide and a national problem that we run into, which is the framing of multilingual learners is often negative. It costs so much. It's, it's a problem. It's a challenge. The truth is, we'd be all better off if we were bilingual and we were, proficient in both languages. The reality in Central Falls is we have a challenge here when it comes to, proficiency rates, things like that. And so I'm curious about what you believe the city needs and the city school system needs to better support multilingual learners so that we can send them off to, our higher ed institutions, ready for college or ready for the workforce.
I think it's important for everybody in this room to know that 52% of our students are MLLs. And when you have some of these students in a classroom with a teacher that doesn't speak their language, the proficiency is never going to change, right? The outcomes are never going to change. We definitely need more resources. This is why I said it's important to speak to the teachers. What do they need in their classrooms, whether it's a teacher assistant? Why aren't we working? There's teachers who have come from their countries who speak Spanish, speak Cape Verdean. The education in some of these countries is very competitive. Like, these are good teachers to have in our schools and help our students. Our students feel comfortable with them. I've been in some of these classrooms, and you can see the interaction with some of these teachers and the students. Why aren't we trying to bring some of those teachers here? The challenge, some of those teachers are here. They have to take the praxis, right? They have to take it in English. They're working with their students in their language, but then they have to take a test in English. If they don't pass the test, they have to continue taking the test. They have to pay, I think it's $250 every time they have to take this test. If they don't pass the test, they can't continue teaching. Like, that's a challenge. So how do we work around that to make sure that these teachers that are coming here from their countries, that we support them? Because we know that they're helping our students in their language. When you have my community is 70% Latino. You have 52% MLLs. Why shouldn't we be supporting the teachers?
And real quick to Lisa, have there been discussions about the praxis being offered in other languages?
Well,
this is the test that teachers take to become a teacher.
Part of that too is, for as far as our graduation rates and what have you, is a certain level of English proficiency for all our teachers as well as our students to be able to graduate. So there is that component. But to your point, you know, right now in our budget, we have an ask for increase in MLL funding, our categorical, to be able to address these very issues. It's not enough. We constantly want to keep adding money. But those that money can support teachers getting certified. It can support teachers getting the praxis help that they need to be able to pass the praxis and do those supports. I mentioned, you know, we hosted some of that. But again, we need more of that. And looking at other ways to support teachers to be able to make it through some of the requirements. We've adjusted, we've even changed making sure like the requirements for people coming into teaching that they're supported but not having that same level. But again, trying to find a way to still elevate the profession, make sure that we have qualified teachers in every building, in every classroom, but providing those supports. And so that is one way that funding can certainly help exactly what the mayor's talking about.
Before we get to audience questions, I have one question for Commissioner Gilkey about something that's been in the news. During the pandemic, a lot of colleges got rid of the SAT requirement for admissions, and now some of them are putting it back in as a requirement to apply to college. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so assessments in general, SAT, ACT, there's, you know, several different products, have been used for, I think, two reasons in this country. Going back for the last 30 years, they've been used for admissions practices, for selection and criteria. They've also been used, and I'm speaking general about higher ed assessments, to help ensure that the college really understands where the student's coming with their respect to their levels of preparation. And this was even way before the Common Core movement through K-12. My opinion is we want students to complete the degree in the program. And if a college president or their academic affairs unit comes and sits down with us and says, hey, we want to use this assessment, it's going to help us, you know, matriculate this student in and then provide support for them to complete, you know, go forth and conquer. If a college comes and says, we don't want to have this assessment anymore because it's going to, again, help us select and then get a student to the finish line, I'm, as the commissioner, I'm looking for outcomes in those institutions, and I want those outcomes to close our equity gaps and fill our workforce problems. And so using the assessment, not using the assessment, I want the institutions to produce educated Rhode Islanders.
I don't actually know. Do you have an assessment requirement at Rhode Island College?
The only institution right now that's reinstated, to my knowledge, the SAT, has been Brown University. I think they did that recently, post-pandemic, and a lot of colleges got rid of it during the pandemic. Currently, none of the publics have reinstated the SAT or standardized test, and certainly CCRI and RIC has not. I can speak to that.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to turn to the audience now. We have Lindsay with the mic, if you want to raise your hand, and she'll come around.
Hi, Kim Almeida, Rhode Island School for Progressive Education. I just wanted to ask a question more about the praxis. We have it's one of the huge barriers for us for we're an educator prep program, for anyone who doesn't know, and we're the only educator prep program with this express mission to diversify the teacher workforce. So we have a potential cohort right now of 30 teachers, most of which are in the classrooms already, recommended by their districts. The students hug them on the way out, and not one of them has yet passed the praxis. So we have zero people in a cohort since we have a residency-style program, and it's an accelerated program, who would be teachers of record starting in September. And like you said, that program has been so awesome for us. That ride is helping us with the prep for that. That's been super helpful. Indeed. But like you said, it's $250 per test. So if somebody has to take the test four times, they owe $1,000. So in my opinion, the funding is helpful, but the funding is a reimbursement usually. So if you asked me for $1,000 right now and we all get to leave when I give it to you because someone outside has it for me, we're all sleeping over. So it's not realistically, if you don't have any money, it doesn't matter if you're getting reimbursed or not. So that's one of the issues. And the parallel to that is, I think 2 years ago, the testing to be licensed for social work in the state was halted because they found it was biased, and the efficacy of the social workers when they were weighted against those who passed the test or didn't, it wasn't dissimilar. So they found that the test, which is very similar to a praxis, right, wasn't really effective, and it didn't matter on the outcomes. So I guess my question is, at the state level, is anybody aware of any initiatives to follow suit, since the barriers are all sociocultural, socio-emotional, socio-economical, and why not? LOL.
Wow. Thank you for your question. Part of it is regulatory, so it is certainly a process. I have a tremendous team in my certification office that looks across the nation and everywhere to see what other states are doing, what other municipalities are trying to do around that testing. It's something we look at all the time. We have really expanded our reciprocity, so other states, whatever their certification, it'll carry over, you know, where they may or may not have to take the praxis, you know, those types of things. So it is always something that we're looking at. We have made changes over the years to address certain praxis or removing them and changing them, as you see, but it goes through a process. And it is something that we're continuously looking at. I know we're looking at certification now to expand certifications. We have some certifications. I'm a former math teacher, and my certification is you know, 7 through 12 for mathematics. And yet, you know, sixth graders are in your building as a middle school teacher, and yet I'm technically would not be able to teach those students unless, you know, I'm on one period a day type of thing. So again, looking at ways to expand certifications to be able to be more 5 to 12 or K through 8, you know, those types of things. So we're constantly looking at ways to not only address what you're talking about, but also to expand and have other options for teachers to lengthen their certification. So I will take it back to my team and continue to look and address that. But it is an issue that we're aware of.
Yeah. And what's happening is some of these teachers are getting discouraged. They're not taking the test anymore, and they're quitting their jobs. And then a substitute ends up in that classroom. So you have a math teacher who's doing an excellent job with these students. They can't pass the test. They're quitting. You have a substitute that doesn't teach math in this classroom. But we expect our kids to succeed.
Hi, everyone. My name is Angela Nakasaga, and I work at the Rhode Island Judiciary. I was actually a Cranston High School East graduate, and one of the programs that was very helpful in paving the pathway for me into my career right now was Prepare RI. So I'm wondering whether there are any incentives on the state level for employers like the Rhode Island Judiciary or Citizens Bank or whatever, any Rhode Island employer to actually go into high schools or any K-12 institution and actually create a pipeline to that career, that specific career where that Rhode Island employer is based in. Thank you.
I'm sorry, what's your name again?
My name is Angela.
Angela, thank you for that. And could you tell me what was that essential ingredient about Prepare RI that made it so valuable?
The essential ingredient was the fact that, well, it happened in the summer, so I was not in school, and I was also getting paid for it.
So,
we still have that.
It was a rhetorical question because I absolutely love that program. And so thank you very much, Angela. I'm going to go back to Daniel about waving a magic wand, you know, and we have some amazing employers in this state, General Boat, Fidelity, I mean, that are really interested in making sure they have pipelines into the, you know, for recruiting. And, if I could wave a magic wand, it would be what you experience at Prepare RI, but I'll say just in broad terms, work-based learning at scale. So, if we could have, and it has to be paid, going back to the student teaching experience that I kind of went into earlier, because we have students that are working. We have, and for adults too. So, you know, on-ramps through education and training that gives real job experience, like a work-based learning experience that gives that, you know, exposure, but actually allows the individual to earn and learn at the same time. Now, that is not to be a substitute to the wonderful apprenticeship mechanisms. It might be a way for there to be an expansion of that. But I think what Prepare RI has done it allows a young person, but also we need it for adult people to kind of get into the workspace at the same time they're getting that educational experience. That's the mode of delivery I think post-secondary really needs to wrestle with. And it's a wonderful time, and I'm highly optimistic for New England and specifically Rhode Island, because higher ed needs the enrollment. You know, we have a declining population. That's a really good time to have a reform agenda, and our employers
need the workforce, because we've got low unemployment and we still have a lot of really good jobs out there and a lot of really good jobs coming down the line. I'll mention life sciences again. So we need those modes of delivery to scale. So thank you for the comment.
Neil Steinberg retired.
Don't rub it in.
So just as an overall thing, and I applaud everything that everybody's doing. I applaud you. This would have been the same conversation 10 years ago. It would have been the same conversation 5 years ago, and my concern is it will be the same conversation in 5 years. Dan was asking about absenteeism. Commissioner Gilkey, wonderful things. We've been hearing about credentials for as long as I've been around here is the next thing. We knew and know the demographic shift. Surprise, surprise, there's less kids in school. We're an aging population. You could find those stories 20 years ago. How do we make focused, bold change to move the ball? How do we get so our kids are all reading at grade level at the end of the day? That's how they get a job. How do we get so our kids are doing math at grade level and showing up? How do we get where absenteeism and multi-language, huge issue, we know that. How do we focus on the half a dozen really important things, move the ball, and stop making up programs every 3 years with a different name, and then we're back here again talking about it. And it's not a slight to anybody individually. Maybe we need a little more leadership here and there, but how do we make that transformative change to really get Rhode Island where it needs to be so that we're not talking about the same subjects over and over?
I know.
Yeah.
Can I start?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's accountability, and I continue to say, you know, what's happening in Central Falls or what has happened in Central Falls for years, it's not something that the superintendent can fix alone. It's not something that the board can fix alone. As the mayor of the city, I can't fix it alone. Wright can't fix it. We all need to be sitting at the table and having this conversation. And the problem is that everybody was having separate conversations, trying to figure out or bringing in different solutions, or a report is being done by this one, a study is being done by this one. That's not going to work. We all have to be sitting at the table and trying to figure out, like, what are the issues and working together. It's so important for us to work together.
I agree. It may sound that a hokey, you know, expression of it takes a village, but it really does. We've seen it, especially during the pandemic, but everyone needs to partner. You know, we partner with Commissioner Gilkey, with municipalities, with the district. Everybody needs to be involved. You're seeing that example with the chronic absenteeism, our Attendance Matter campaign. Everybody probably in this room has been involved in some way. We talk about it everywhere we go. Everybody needs to be supporting our schools, our teachers, our higher ed, really pulling together and making things happen together. I agree. I can't do it myself. Every teacher in this room can't do it by themselves. Every administrator in this room, employers, parents. It really does. We do really need to come together and make it happen.
Last word to the commissioner.
Yeah, the headline is, you know, build on what works and cut out the things that don't. And so let me give you two examples, Neil. One, something that I don't think works. If we are producing credentials that don't align to good jobs, we need to cut that out. And that's really hard to do. That's a big question, because I believe the liberal arts leads to a good job. I really do. And so we can't cut out that. But if you're getting a credential in Rhode Island higher education that doesn't have a direct correlation to that return on investment for the individual, then we need to focus on that. And then build upon the things that's working. And I'll leave you guys with this. So I have a pin on. Thank you, Mayor, for wearing your pin. We know that if you remove a non-academic barrier for an adult, you get them to the finish line. So we launched a program a few years ago called Rhode Island Reconnect that spends between $1,500 and $4,000 food insecurity, transportation. The Governor McKee and the General Assembly put another $8 million in it last year. And we've served over 3,000 participants across all age paradigms to get them back into post-secondary by just removing the non-academic barrier. So getting a translator, buying a laptop, mental health services, and we just pay the bill. 87% of the time, they finish. And in a world of post-secondary where we see graduation rates at 20 and 30%, we're like, what are we doing here? I'll take 87% completion all day long. And I think helping remove when life gets in the way, I think we have to focus on things that are working and the data tells us work, and then cut out the other stuff.
A huge round of applause for our panel. This went really quick.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was a special taping of Roadmap Live, the State of Rhode Island Schools. The free in-person event at CIC Providence featured Post-Secondary Commissioner Shannon Gilkey, Deputy Ride Commissioner Lisa Odom Villela, and Central Falls Mayor Maria Rivera. The conversation was moderated by our own Dan McGowan and Steph Machado. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with our regular episode next week.